Hallito and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki. Welcome back, y'all. As we're celebrating 100 episodes of Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all, my husband Nick and our dog Taloa are walking through clips of some of our most beloved episodes. By the way, if you're not tuning in on YouTube, you probably should go there because right now we're doing everything we can to keep my dog entertained to be on camera. But first, you may have noticed these 100th episode t-shirts we're wearing today. If you'd like to share in the fun, feel free to go to cafepress.com/Native Chalk Talk and click on the Celebration Yenish, the buffalo with the party hat on. You'll find these t-shirts and accessories there, and a portion of proceeds will go to Native causes. All right, Nick, what do you have for us?
All right, Taloa, you want to draw from the bowl this time? Mommy, what is your background?
Well, Taloa, I grew up in Anadarko, Oklahoma, in a little place 5 miles west of town called Haw Creek. And I rode the bus with my two older sisters, Stacy and Skylar, to public school until second grade for me. And then I went to a Christian school until sixth grade, and then I homeschooled through 12th grade. So ironically, I grew up singing opera of all things and taking voice lessons starting at age 12. And I loved opera and thought that that's what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And somehow magically, I'd be able to make a living doing that. So I still sing a little bit today, but I did love my career. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. I also was in infomercials and commercials for many years and would even write and direct commercials as well. And like I mentioned earlier, I was a dating and relationships columnist for a few years as well. So I started working at the age of 12. Since I homeschooled, it made working possible. And I started college at Southwestern Oklahoma State University, go Bulldogs. In fact, my friend Jenny and I were the very first homeschoolers to ever go to SWASU. And then I finished my degree at Butler University, also go Bulldogs. Funny because my daughter Alex went to Yale, which was also Bulldogs. Anyway, I've been in sales for many years in the technology field, and I sell software that helps telecom managers at large corporations to manage their end of life of their tens of thousands of corporate, you know, smartphones, tablets, and laptop devices. So our software helps to recover these devices, and then we'll resell or recycle those assets and provide project managers to help with these projects. So I love it.
So this isn't your full-time gig, huh?
No, even though it's like a full-time gig that I don't get paid for, but I absolutely do love it.
Well, that being the case, maybe we should show another clip.
Yes, let's do it. Gig.
And I think our dog has quit on us.
She's out. Okay, yeah. Fine then. Quit her. It is like 9:30 at night, so she's done. In this snippet from season 1, episode 4, Comanche Rance Wiriakwi, a professor at the University of Oklahoma, enlightens us about the historical significance of the Buffalo Wallows that once lay beneath the Sooners football field. Additionally, he sheds light on the campus's rich history once dominated by Comanche hunting grounds. He treats us to the soul-stirring melody of Comanche Hymn Number 48 as well. You don't want to miss it.
Now, you've also talked about the space of OU and the Indian land on which it was built.
Yeah. So that's when, in my research, I came across some nice little tidbits of information, but one of them in particular was basically the campus is set on some old Comanche hunting grounds. Yeah, sure. these were Native American hunting grounds. These were Comanche hunting grounds. This area was mainly wetland, but there were areas where buffaloes came, and we came, as the Comanches, we came up there and hunted those, used as hunting grounds. So we kind of, when I was writing this thesis, I kind of looked at this as the getting place, place there where at one point in time we came to get resources for survival. And nowadays, as Native American students and Native American faculty, we're coming to, again, have access to resources, access to, you know, education and information that maybe we can take back to our communities and use for, you know, assist our nations.
I love that. It was the getting place for hunting for buffalo, and now it's the getting place for education.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, yeah, you know, so when in my research, you know, I looked at, you know, areas about football was, you know, I'm a sports fanatic, a real big OU football fan. So football was a kind of my avenue, my vehicle into looking through these issues and these situations on campus at OU. When I did some of my research, I came across where the first actual football field was currently where the Fred Jones Museum stands. That's on the corner of Boyd and Asp, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Jones Museum sits on a place where it was once the first football field. And the research I came across talked about how the football field was filled with buffalo wallows.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they had to fill those buffalo wallows in order to make it a flat plain.
That's fascinating.
This was a Comanche hymn. It's called Comanche Hymn Number 48. It doesn't have a title, but it was composed by Otobi. I am no relation to Otobi, but I just really like this song. It's resonated with me. There are songs that, you know, have been known as family songs, mm-hmm. like songs that, you know, my grandpa would like, or his favorite song.
Yeah.
But this, like I said, this one's a little more upbeat, so I chose to sing this one.
All right. Thank you.
Okitana tomo va tita apa ni pana hai tuyana. Matabi toi kikunana, matabi miya niyakunan, matabi ika vetu tanata, nada miya nipana aitayana. Okitana tomo vatita hapa nipana aitayana, matabi toi kikunana, matabi miya niyakunan, matabi ika vetu tanata, nada miya. Nipana ai toyana. Okitana tomo vatita apa nipana ai toyana. Matabi toi kikunana matabi mia nikunan. Matabi ika vetu tanata nada mia nipana ai toyana. Okitana tomo vatita apa nipana aituyana. Matabi toi kikunana matabi mia nikunan. Matabi ika vetu tanata nada mia nipana aituyana. And the translation to this song is up in heaven, we're going to praise our Father. As the sun comes up, as the sun travels, as the sun goes down, we're going to praise our Father.
What'd you think of Rance's episode, Nick?
I liked Rance's episode. I think he's got a great wealth of knowledge. And of course, being a fellow Comanche.
You are ridiculous. What are we going to do with you?
But you know, it really does show there's just such a wealth of knowledge out there. And so many folks have so much to talk about,
yeah.
And none of it's written. So that's why it's great that you have this podcast that allows people to kind of speak up.
I appreciate that.
All right. So let's get another question here. When did Native Chalk Talk start?
Okay. Native Chalk Talk launched on August 11th, 2021. And I first started my LLC in Illinois, but I've now moved it to Oklahoma. I've completed, as you know, 5 seasons, and we're currently at the end of season 6 right now. And of course, this is my 100th episode. So more info, if anyone is curious, is I typically launch each episode weekly on Thursdays, unless I'm on the road for work. And then it can be any of the days before or after. In seasons 1 through 3, I only did audio, and it was actually much easier to do audio. But starting in season 4, I also added video. So if you're watching this episode on YouTube, you'll see the clips don't have video until I get to the clips from seasons 4 through 5.
Okay, that's great. Yeah. And I'm kind of disappointed, though, you didn't really give my, you know, name Native Chalky Talky a chance, but
it was in consideration, I promise.
Okay. You know, I thought that was just creative, you know?
Very creative. But interestingly enough, now that you say that, it was actually Alexandria, my daughter, who came up with the name Native Chalk Talk. So I do owe her that.
But Chalky Talky sounds like Walkie Talk.
It does. I love that name. Maybe if we do another podcast someday,
okay,
we'll call it Chalky Talky.
All right. All right. So another question here. What tribes have you interviewed so far?
All right. I have interviewed Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas, Caddo, Kiowa, Comanche, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Chippewa, Choctaw, of course, Chumash, Creek, Hawitha, Navajo, Oneida, Osage, Nomlaki Band of Paskenta Indians, Seminole, Yurok. There's many more, I'm sure. And I'm excited because next season, season 7, I'll be interviewing a gentleman from Alaska. So that will be the first time to get to speak with an Alaskan. And I think it's time to share another clip. What do you think?
I think so, too. But, you know, when you go through that list, I'm really impressed because I think most people don't know most of those tribes even existed.
So true, right? And including myself.
Yeah. So when you think of, you know, Native Americans, I think what really comes, or first Americans, really, a lot of people know Cherokee, a lot of people know Choctaw, Comanches, you know, Arapahos, Navajos, maybe even some Kiowas, depending on where you are, Seminoles, obviously, but all the other tribes and other sects of those tribes, it's great that you're getting more information on them as well.
Awesome. Thank you for saying that. And actually, for me, something that I've wanted to do from day one with this podcast is it's not about me knowing everything there is to know about all the tribes, not at all. It's other tribes and I talking about their tribes, their history, their stories. And so I am learning along with my guests the whole way as well. So again, you and I getting to see these different tribes we had never even heard of before is super cool. I love it.
Yeah, and they travel. As we've gone to some of these powwows, I'm always impressed to see who's out there. I think we were in Michigan one time, and I ran into a kid on an elevator who is an Inuit from Alaska, and he came all the way to Michigan to participate in the...
Oh, that's so cool. So many of these First Nations people can get together after some of them were warring tribes in the past. And wouldn't our ancestors be so proud? Or ashamed. I don't know. They might be like, what are you doing? You do not know how long we've been fighting with these people. I've thought about that before, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So you wanted to roll another clip.
Yes. So Solomon Tonica, I know you loved his episode too. Prepare to be enthralled by the captivating narratives of Solomon Tonica, a Choctaw who undoubtedly is one of the finest storytellers I've had the pleasure of encountering. In season 1, episode 10, I journeyed to Wright City, Oklahoma, where Solomon and his wife graciously welcomed me into their home. Together, we embarked on a memorable day exploring the family's original land allotments, immersing ourselves in the rich tapestry of history woven into every corner. As Solomon shares his tales, you'll be treated to the melodic rhythms of the Choctaw language, adding an authentic touch to his storytelling. From recounting the ancient traditions of stickball games to unveiling the riveting saga of the Mexican bandits, Solomon offers a glimpse into a world not found within the pages of history books. Get ready for an unforgettable journey filled with wisdom, culture, and the timeless art storytelling.
And you even mentioned that the stickball games were warlike, as they tend to be anyway, but sounds like there was even death.
Yes,
during this time.
You don't hear about it nowadays. They talk about stickball, and I heard one guy, I won't mention names, but I heard one guy telling, it was a bunch of white people down here, he's telling about a stickball game. It's a friendly game. Well, I was taught it was, that's what settled disputes.
Right.
And when they come together, they didn't come together and to have a good time. The families came, they cooked, the ones that were going to doctor them up, they came. And whenever they get out there, it was a battle to win. A lot of times, when they hit them with that stick, it cut somebody open, it just blood would squirt out. And sometimes they'd knock them out. They'd have to, the women would run after. Because the game's still going, they ain't going to stop for you because you got hurt. The women would drag the man off. doctor them up, whatever, and then here they go again, you know, and sometimes death.
Wow.
They don't tell stories like that. You don't read that in the book, but that's what the old ones talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And right down here, a lot of, well, I guess I might be the only one that knows, but right just down here where the cemetery is, and my daughter lives at the end where my granny's old place, just south of there, about a little over a quarter of a mile, is a kind of clear. And it looked like where they logged, that's where they sent it. They always park there,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they bring the logs and the trucks come with. That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
But when the trees are planted and they grow, nothing grows there.
Hmm.
And my dad said, that's where they used to play stickball.
Oh.
Too much hated blood was spilled on that place, sometimes even death. And when they come to settle their disputes, the too much bloodshed. And so he said, that's why the trees won't grow there. Now, warehouse, I know, it's, you know, in my time, have planted three times. I used to hunt over there before it leased, become leased land. And that open spot, my dad said, there ain't nothing going to grow there because that's where the stickball games used to be played. But that hill over there, he said, you had to be knocking
mm-hmm.
to play there because it had a lot of rock. And, you know, running barefoot and stuff was not good, but you had to be a knocking man. You got to be a man to play there.
Wow.
And they were, there was a central meeting place there where they played a stickball. My cousin, she was 14, 15, 16, something years younger than my dad. But my granny raised her when her mom died. And my dad said whenever she was little, her mama had died. So granny was raising her. And they was all sitting outside, you know, where my daughter lives now.
Mm-hmm.
And she was sitting there. And it's just south of there where that stickball field is. Anyway, she was out there in the yard. In those days, kids didn't play in the dark. Mm-hmm. But they say, Kanunka shall get you. You know, the little people, you just didn't do certain things.
Yeah.
You know what, she was sitting there and she cupped her hands like this. And you know how people, they can do that. I can't do it right now, but you know how they make it.
Yeah.
Used to when we was kids,
yeah,
you could
we
do
used
that.
To do that all the
she
time.
She did that and she blow. And when she did, just south of there towards that old stickball field, it sounded like a man. He went, oh! And just, it was almost like a growl. But and my granny said, Mom, can I see Panya? She said, watch out, you call somebody.
Stop calling
and,
him.
You know, yeah. But I never went over there. And, you know, I've hunted through there many a times as a kid, you know, and even when I was growing up, I'd go through there, but I never did go there. Not,
no.
You know, yeah.
I wouldn't either.
Yeah.
You mentioned one time that the witch doctors would even get to the field early, right, before
right,
the stickball game.
Right.
What was their role there?
My dad and my granny used to talk about in those days, a lot of the coaches were Indian doctors.
Mm.
So when they come to battle, not only was it a rigorous game on the field and very physical, even the powers that be, the doctors came and they run, jump on the field, fall, do flips, run, slide, and trying to work their magic. And so whoever had the best magic, the best warlike players,
mm-hmm.
they're the ones that win. They even want the spirits to help them out.
Hmm.
That's why the doctors came. I remember a story of my granny. When I was little, we were sitting on a porch, and she said when she was little, she went to one of them games. You know, after a while, they couldn't even play the stickball game because it was too fierce.
Hmm.
But she said she was at a stickball game, and one of them, Chuck Lichty, had his team all lined up on one side, and he done something. And, you know, it was daytime. The sun was shining, and it was just like a big mirror. It covered the whole team, and it blinded everybody on the other side, the players and, you know, and the coach. He said, oh, Cono, and he reached in his bag like this, and whatever he had, he threw it like this. And this mirror or whatever supposedly was, you know, blinding, it just shattered.
Oh, my gosh.
But there wasn't nothing on the ground because it's all spiritual. But she used to tell that story. She seen that.
Wow.
So, you know, it was to settle disputes. It wasn't always, you know, I don't know if they had friendly games.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was taught, it was to settle disputes. And it was a very physical game. and even sometimes death.
You talked about the story of some Mexican bandits that, again, you won't find in the history books. Tell us right. more about that.
The elders used to talk about Mexican coming in here and raiding, you know, a few times, and they'd had to, I don't know what all they done to them, but they would come riding through, and they had to defend themselves. They was going to be prepared. And they said, Himokonogolokoma, Ilibachin. They was prepared. This time when they come, we're going to kill them. And so the bandits came again across the river and come through, and they this time they were ready. Mm-hmm. And they chased them back. I don't know if it's this river or the Red River, but they talk about they killed about 20, 25 of them, shot them while they were trying to cross the river, and they just floated on. And that was one of the stories I was told. So I was at Wheelock. They had a history meeting, and one of the historians and elder, you know, a white guy was there. And I said something about that, and I said, I never, you know, read it in books or anything. I never. And he looked at me, and he said, no, nothing like that has ever happened.
Wow, you he know, just shut it down?
He shut me off, so I won't ever say it again.
What I really liked about that episode is Solomon is just such a great story.
Yeah.
Right? He just tells a great story.
He's so into it.
It just comes across. And that's what you're really looking for. Those folks that have those deep stories to bring out. And as we get to hear more and more of that, it's kind of like you want to hear other things he has to say. I think Solomon has plenty to say, right?
Yeah.
He has not so many things to say, but there's definitely some great history underneath. What he's got with all that. So let me grab another question.
Okay.
And let me see if this one's. What is the most challenging thing about doing Native chocolate?
It's a mixed bag, honestly. And of course, all the challenges pale in comparison to getting to do this. But I'd say the time it takes is a challenge in itself, as you know. I really don't have much of a life outside of work and the podcast, but going on site is so darn hard. I'm trying to teach myself how to better record when I'm on site. Like you and I are on site, but we're both still on Zoom. But I don't want to do Zoom when I'm on site with someone. So trying to work the right equipment, and it's just me by myself setting it all up, making sure it's working properly while it's set up and that the recording doesn't stop for some reason or a mic runs out of battery. It's all very challenging, and it's something I'm trying to make perfect. But this brings me to another thought. I do 100% of everything for this podcast myself, finding the guests, vetting them, researching, recording, the technology, the editing, putting everything on social media and promoting it, putting it on my website. It's a lot of work and it's not cheap. As you know, Nick, we both have put our money into this and it's not cheap. So I think people start podcasts thinking it's just an easy thing that you throw together, but each episode typically costs me about 20 plus hours of work. And again, part of that is research. Whether or not I share my research during the podcast, I still do hours of studying ahead of time. I want to do my guests proud, our ancestors proud, the history proud. And if I have the time for my guests, I'm looking up their history for hours and hours of studying ahead of time. Nick and I sometimes will be in the basement and we'll have the TV on and I'll be working on my research and I'll go, oh my gosh, I just found so-and-so's great, great, great grandfather that they've been looking for. And you're looking at me like, that's great, honey. And he has no idea what I'm talking about, but he's always so supportive. Anyway, so if I have the time for many of my guests, I'm looking up their history on ancestry.com, on newspapers.com, and other places. And I'm trying to understand their stories as much as I can. And then also sometimes I'm able to find information that they may not have known or photos they've never seen before. So I'd say about 10% or so of the information you'll hear some of my guests share is actually from my research. So having said all of that, I need funding. I'm not a 501c3 on purpose. I'm way in the hole when you and I have invested our money into this, Nick, not expecting to turn a profit. I still would love to pay us back someday if I can. That may or may not happen. Either way, I need funding for when I travel on site to see my guests. I have monthly fees for website hosting, Zoom, editing tools, a bunch of other things. So this is also my note, my shameless plug, that if you would like to advertise with me or to donate or to help me find a grant, or if your company would like to sponsor Native Chalk Talk, please let me know.
Very true. We have poured quite a bit into this, and obviously it's not about, it was never about making money. It's always right. been about the idea of getting the stories out there and being able to communicate with everyone. But it has been a challenge sometimes. I understand, because it's you put in the time in and the car, sometimes making long road trips and different things like that. So that can definitely be difficult. So I know you want to do more with this, though. And as the opportunities have kind of grown through the podcast, what do you want to do beyond the podcast? You want to do more, don't you?
Yeah. I definitely would love to do more. I would love to start to do this as more of a documentary. So each guest would get to tell their story, and I'd have researchers in the background who would be much better than I am at research to really put in good information about not only the ancestors of my guests, but also information about the tribes themselves, what was going on in history at the time, and going to those places we're talking about in the episode. So I have this vision of that each episode can be so much more and have those visuals. If you're not standing in the place where certain tribes were standing during a battle, or raised their children, or you know, did their sweat ceremonies, whatever it is, it's really hard to picture it all. And when you're standing there, you feel this sense of, wow, this really happened. This is not folklore. This is not just something in the history books. This actually happened. And I'm talking to the descendants of the people that once stood here. So I'd really love to be taking storytelling to the next level. And there are certain places in Oklahoma, for instance, as you know, Nick, that no one knows about, that has interesting historical significance. I know about these places, but I need funding to go get this going. So I'm open. Any help is appreciated. If you're interested, reach out to me at ryoungman@nativechalktalk.com. Again, another shameless plug. Thank you for listening.
Well, that's great. And definitely having the AV guy would be a help too, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
With all the technical pieces that you were with. I'm assuming the AV club wasn't a thing at home school.
No, we didn't.
Your dad didn't have to just like take apart the TV and put it back together or anything?
No, I mean, that should have been part of my curriculum. It would have served me really well at this point.
You know, hook up the VCR, disconnect the VCR.
Right, you know, use a microphone.
Technology's come a little bit further than...
Learn how to edit, eh?
All right, well, let's take a look at another clip.
Okay.
This one is from our friend Monroe Satok. And Monroe was one of the first folks that got to try my fry bread.
That's right. Yes.
And we oftentimes see Monroe when we get a chance to visit down in Oklahoma.
Yes, our good friend, Monroe Satok, he's Kiowa. And his family, they hold a very special place in our hearts. They're more than friends, they're family. My father and Monroe shared a passion for art and taught together at Riverside Indian School in our hometown of Anadarko, Oklahoma. And in this captivating clip, Monroe shares about his ancestors' encounters with boarding schools and the remarkable tales of his grandfather, Hunting Horse, descended from a distinguished line of Kiowa luminaries, such as the renowned Kiowa Five artist, Monroe Satok, whom he's named after, Hunting Horse, and a Kiowa co-talker. Monroe's family history is a treasure trove of cultural heritage and resilience. I urge you to delve into both parts of this episode in season one, episode 5, where you'll be treated to a wealth of captivating stories about his family. Towards the end of this clip, listen closely as Monroe bestows a heartfelt blessing upon us in his native Kiowa tongue. By the way, Monroe showcases his exquisite art on my Etsy page with a portion of proceeds dedicated to Native causes. Explore his stunning creations at etsy.com/shop/Native Chalk Talk. Monroe is currently working on some new original pieces, so be sure to check back periodically for updates. And Monroe, thank you for putting up with Nick and his first round of Indian tacos. Actually, they were actually really good. That was good fried bread, Nick.
That's right. And Monroe also made me an honorary Kiowa.
Oh, that's right. So you, I forgot about that. You are Kiowa and Comanche.
That's right. Wow. Fully indoctrinated in all of it.
Right. Would, are you going to accept honorary Choctaw too, or no?
You know, Choctaw is cool. We could make it work.
Oh, good to know. Thank you.
Do you have the authority to give me the honorary Choctaw?
I'm going
to
the chief too. You already wanted to go
I'll
Comanche
the chief
first.
And
no.
Make it cool.
No.
Yes. I got to get the chief's approval on that one.
Oh, you're going to go straight to Batten.
I'm going straight to Batten.
Man. I may slip him a 20 to not allow this to happen.
Aho, day on day, and bon, good time on call. Aho. That was Kiowa just a little bit. I said, nice to meet you. Or I haven't met you, but I'm talking to you. And my grandfather named me, and I told my name in Kiowa, which is Skutayom, means white wolf. I said, ready to go. Let me go back a little bit further. My grandmother went to a mission school, and I believe it was Catholic. She was little, and of course they, you know, cut their hair and put on a certain kind of clothing. And so one time, this matron, and my grandma, she still didn't speak very good English. And this matron got my grandma and another girl, and she took them to the attic of that dormitory. And when she went up to the dormitory, up all the way to the attic, she had a basket of socks. When they got up to the attic, they went in, the matron put the basket in the middle of the floor, and then she told them in English something to do. And of course, them not understanding fully English. And then that matron left, and her and that little other girl, they were standing in the middle of the room and looking at each other and didn't know what to do. So they just kind of figured for themselves that in their minds, they said, well, maybe she wants us to start putting them on. And so that's what they did. They sat on the floor and they began to put those socks on one at a time on their feet. And when the matron came back, she seen those all those pairs of socks on their feet that matron make them take the socks off, and she scolded them, whipping them for not doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. So that's just one story, you know, a communication that my grandmother told us. Hunting Horse is my great grandfather. You know, the Kiowa history, it goes back, as far as I know, there's other stories, but origination is from around that Yellowstone area. And some people say that they came from Canada down. They were in the Yellowstone area of Wyoming for a while, and then they moved to the Black Hills, and they were there for a while, made friends with the Crow and several of the other tribes. But they were forced out of that Black Hills area by the Lakotas, Dakotas, and because they were bigger tribes. And so moving down this way through Kansas, and Hunting Horse, he was a little boy when they were traveling, and his father's name was Turtle. And the story just mentions Hunting Horse and his dad and mom. They were coming, and I'm sure that they were with a group of Kiowas. And when they got into around Oklahoma, Kansas, they were, I guess, attacked by the Pawnees. And when they were in the skirmish battle, Hunting Horse's dad, Turtle, got killed. So Hunting Horse and his mother were taken captive to the Pawnee, and he stayed there a long time. I won't go into details because it's a story in itself. But the Pawnees are related, or they have family with the Wichitas. And so when the Pawnees came to visit the Wichitas, they seen Hunting Horse. By that time, his mother had died because of physical abuse. Because
they were taken as slaves, right?
Yeah, they were mistreated. And anyway, the Wichitas traded for Hunting Horse, a mule and rifles or something like that. And so Hunting Horse grew up in the Wichita tribe from a little boy up into a young age. And I believe that he even married into the Wichita tribe at first. And then they were having a big ceremony in southwest Oklahoma with all of the Kiowas, Comanches, and other tribes. I'm not sure exactly what the gathering was. Might have been a sun dance, but they were all there. And the Wichitas went there with the and the Pawnees. There were some there, too. And so when they went there, the Kiowas recognized hunting horse. And so they went to talk to the Wichitas, and they bartered to give him back to the Kiowas. And so that's how he made his way back to the Kiowas. His mother and father got killed, but he made it all the way back to his own people.
And then he went on his first raid when he was 12 years old, right?
Yes. They were getting a war party to go down into Texas. He wanted to go with them. So, you know, at that time, I guess 12 nowadays, you know, think of that's too young, you can't go. But back then, you know, it's a part of life, survival. So they let him go, and they said he needed to paint up. So his colors that he used was white, and he painted, you know, his face and his arms, and he put like maroon stripes on his face and his arms and on his horse. And when they went down, they came up on some settlers. And so being 12, the older warriors, they didn't want him to go. So what they told him to do was to stay back, being so young, and hold on to the horses. And when they get ready to leave, that all they can do is run up, grab their horse, and take off if they were being followed or being attacked. So that was his job. And actually, that's where he got his name, Hunting Horse. They thaw hollow, donkey pine my thaw my thaw day. Donkey they honda yon on, donkey I they honda yon on yon high yon dog. Uncle all coyon bay do him. Beg your donkey, I mean, they keep your old boy dog. He go be tied do, he go be tied do, I con bay do. Heavenly Father, above the clouds, we thank you for making life. Jesus Christ, we thank you for dying on the cross for us. Thank you, Holy Spirit, for being with us. Continue to be with us. Watch over us. Forgive us for our shortcomings. All these things I ask in the name of Jesus Christ, Son of the living God. Amen.
So that was a great episode. I think I lost my dog. But anyway, she wants to know if she could have a snack. Come here. Come on.
Oh my goodness. She is too much. Well, while Toloa enjoys this snack, we're going to go to the next clip. It was truly a privilege to spend time with Fawn Satoke, the daughter of Monroe Satoke. Fawn shared with me two deeply personal and harrowing stories, experiences she survived against all odds. Despite the hardships she faced, Fawn's resilience and compassion shine through as she channels her own struggles into a powerful drive to help others. As the president of the Missing Murdered Indigenous People Kiowa chapter, she tirelessly advocates for justice and support for those in need. Fawn embodies the qualities of a true leader and a compassionate friend, someone you want by your side in times of trouble or simply to offer a comforting embrace. This Kiowa woman is a force to be reckoned with, and I am honored to call her my sister. Listen to her story in this clip from season 1, episode 9.
I was either going to tell him or he was going to tell me. And I was reaching for, you know, I always carried something in my door handle just for any type of circumstance. And I'm very, very fortunate for me that I did not find what I was looking for. Instead, I found the door handle. And in between times of him letting go to get a better grip on my hair, I managed to pull the door and get out in one full swoop. And once I did that, I ran across the road and I jumped a fence and I laid down on my belly. We had an SUV at the time, so it took him a while to go around the vehicle. And I believe those few seconds, extra seconds, is what helped me to hide. And I would never wish what I had upon anyone. It was the most scariest time of my life to actually have to call 911 on yourself and then pass out.
Wow.
Is amazing that they found me, was able to tend to me, take care of me, and got me to the hospital, and I was able to receive the care that I needed. And I'll never forget that feeling. I'm currently the president of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Kiowa chapter. Our mission statement is to provide support to all Kiowa and to all MMIP families and chapters. We've had one kidnapping since January 1st, and it was the mother who was held at gunpoint and taken by the child's father. Drugs were involved, abusive relationship is another one. One night we get a call from a lady who said her daughter got hit in the head with a sledgehammer. Ugh. The daughter was able to go to the hospital because of her own circumstances, and sometimes it's because they're afraid of the threats that the abuser makes, or because they themselves possibly have some sort of warrant or issue with the police or some, you know, a child protective case going on or whatnot, and they themselves are intimidated to reach out for help.
So that was really an eye-opening moment with Fawn. I'm so proud of her for what she's doing to turn that tragedy into helping others. Thank you, Fawn. By the way, I'd like to thank all my guests for being on the show, and also to Choctaw Nation for cheering me on, and to my advertisers. I'm finally getting some advertisers going and even had a couple of donations, so I appreciate you all. You know, earlier I had mentioned I was really terrified to start this podcast, and I've had nothing but love and support beyond what I ever could have imagined. All right, what's next?
First of all, you know, that episode is great with Fawn. And the knowledge that we've gotten from the MMIW is really impressive. You don't know how extreme it is until you start hearing the stories.
So true,
and
right?
There's so much going on that nobody knows about.
Mm-hmm.
It's really eye-opening the more you get to talk to individuals, the stories you hear. And it's almost like it's forgotten. So
right?
It's been very unique to hear that and be a part of that. So great work by Fawn, for sure.
Much agreed. Thanks for saying that, honey.
So let's jump into the next clip, which is one of my favorite, the Schaffner family, right? This is your family. Obviously, your grandpa was kind of a fun-hearted character. Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet him. He passed by that time. But your aunts and uncles, I think, kind of keep all that alive pretty well.
True.
As we also found out through some of these other stories.
So true. Okay, y'all. Episode 6 from season 1 always gets me emotional. I mean, seriously, it's hard not to tear up or even have a full-on ugly cry when I listen to it. We're talking about my grandpa, my Papa Schaff, the Choctaw fighter pilot who filled us all with immense pride. Gathering with my aunts and uncles, we shared stories about this brilliant, hardworking, and occasionally mischievous man who never failed to leave a lasting impression. From daring stunts like flying a plane down Main Street to other escapades that we may or may not be able to confirm, let alone deny, Papa Schaff's adventures are legendary. I urge you not only to listen to this clip, but also to dive into the full episode. Take a trip down memory lane with us as we reminisce about a man who served our country with valor and left an indelible mark on all of our hearts.
It's an exciting day, y'all. I'm here in Wayne, Oklahoma with my aunts and uncles, quite possibly the biggest troublemakers of them all, to talk about my grandpa, William Creeley Schaffner, or as we grandkids affectionately called him, Papa Schaff. He grew up as a typical Choctaw boy, running around his family's Oklahoma farm in his striped overalls, and then he left the farm to serve in the Air Force, returning a highly decorated fighter pilot and hero of Oklahoma. Newspapers across the country and even throughout the world reported of his heroic battles in the air. One paper called The News from Frederick, Maryland, wrote an article in 1952 entitled, Two Red Jets Are Damaged. Seoul, Korea, February 7th. An American Saber jet pilot damaged two red MiG jets in a 3-minute battle high over the snow-swept North Korea today. Lieutenant William C. Schaffner of Wayne, Oklahoma, riddled the two MiGs in a fight involving 17 Sabres and 30 red jets. The Sabre jets were flying escort for Allied fighter bombers, which took to the skies as snow clouds cleared during the afternoon. Pilots reported cutting red rail lines at 71 points and destroying or damaging 12 supply buildings. Light snow fell all along the battle line. UN raiding parties hit the Reds west of Chorwan, one-time anchor of the communist Iron Triangle. One unit fought two sharp 25-minute battles in the snow before returning to its own lines. The other reached its objective on high ground without trouble and returned while snow still was falling. Red infantrymen made three small early morning probes of UN positions in the center and extreme east of the battlefront, but pulled back under fire. This air warrior may have had a tough exterior, but number one in his life was always his family.
He actually flew many flights over deep into North Korean areas, destroying railroads and trains and strafing other airfields and things like that. But he really did a lot of work up in North Korea, way up north in there.
He flew 100 missions.
Yeah, wow. 100 missions. He flew, when he first went over there, he flew F-80 shooting star jets. And they began fighting with those. But then the newer and better, the F-86 Sabre, came over there, and it was a lot faster and more maneuverable. The shooting stars could just go up to about 500 miles an hour, but the Sabre jet could go up to 650 miles an hour, and it could break the sound barrier of 770 miles an hour.
Wow.
And it's just a lot more maneuverable, and they could carry more weapons underneath the wings, bombing and rockets, and then, of course, the 50-millimeter cannons that they used. It was a plus for them to be getting that jet, and it really helped win the war.
And yet there is still so much to tell about this stoic and heroic man, because, you see, we knew an additional thing or two about this fighter pilot. He was a bit ornery, and he also took a few liberties when it came to flying after the war as a civilian. Papashoff owned a plane, a Cessna 206, and he didn't hesitate to enjoy life to the fullest. Mark, why don't you tell us about his living his life maybe a little too much to the fullest?
Well, most of what I know has been told to me by what I call the old timers. Most of them are gone now, but they would tell about times when he would come in on leave and they would loan him a plane. He would basically buzz the town of Wayne to get everybody out, and he would give them an air show. These old timers, they would tell me, and when they told me, they started talking real quiet. Yeah, he would give us a show, but if they found out about it, they'd have kicked him out of the Air Force. So we never told anybody.
Was that in his Cessna, or was it in something
no,
else?
No, that would have been a loaner from the Air Force, I believe.
Okay, so he had a jet.
A loaner. This is all hearsay. We don't
this
know
for sure.
We can neither confirm nor deny.
Oh, well, Mark, what was that about Main Street?
Oh, they told me one time, said there's little old ladies used to sit on the bench there on Main Street away. They would dip in their snuff. And one day, this plane flew right down the middle of Main Street of Wayne, caused the old women to pee their dresses and swallow their snuff. And come to find out, Dad was the one flying that plane.
Was it the jet? The borrowed jet?
I don't know. I can neither confirm nor deny.
I've always appreciated that you love my family. And when we're in Oklahoma, you're all in, whether it's hunting snakes or flying with my brother-in-law, he teaches flying lessons, or hanging out in the pastures or running on the hay bales or just sitting and visiting. You never thought twice. What do you think about my aunts and uncles that are in the episode? They're so funny, aren't they?
They are very funny. It's funny because they all look so much younger than they are. But it's also... it's fun to get together with all of them because there's a whole energy around them, and you have a lot of kids like that, and they all got their your Papashoff's spirit, right?
Right.
I mean, true. It's kind of interesting when you think about generational how things become, but you know, your grandpa's generation or our grandpa's generations, you talk about that, they were just so tough,
mm-hmm.
and they just didn't take things nearly as seriously is maybe we do now, or we stress all the time and everything else.
Right.
And they were thrown into wars. They were thrown into dangerous situations. But your grandpa also had a good time. Like,
yeah,
he hit a cow with a plane. I mean, that's impressive. It's one of my favorite stories of all time.
He tipped his own cow with the plane.
Yeah, but he crashed the plane. But he was just like, I'm not going to not stop flying. I'm just going to,
you know,
get back on the horse. So how tough is that? I mean, that's impressive. If I crash in a plane, I'm driving or walking from then on. So.
Yeah. No, no way. You know, you're coming from way up in the sky, you know, down to the ground.
Right. Fortunately, your brother-in-law does not do that. He does not.
No, he does not crash. Not
zoom close to the ground, but it is a fun group of people. And you really get the heart of Oklahoma through all of them.
You so know, true.
Growing up in really, really small towns.
Yes. Yes. Small towns where everybody knows everybody and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And they don't want to leave. It's kind of funny. They're very.
They love it there.
All right. You and I listened to the audiobook, Killers of the Flower Moon, many years ago when we were on a road trip.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's been a movie made about it. And it's really brought the spotlight on what happened with the Osage and the Guardians and the Headrights. But not only that, what happened with your family and kind of how you were had a guardianship. Tell us about that and then we'll roll into this next clip.
Yeah. So my great grandmother, Ella, that I talk about quite a bit, that was really the motivation behind this whole podcast. She was, I don't know what better word to use, but she was sold to a white guardian named J.D. Anderson of Sulphur, Oklahoma. And over time, we realized it was also her half-sister that was also sold, as well as several of her aunts and uncles. And so they were all under his roof, treated as slaves and in servitude. So they would tend to his farm, and he had a lot of land, tend to the cattle. And my great-grandmother was only 3 years old when she was sold to the Anderson family. And there was no murder going on that we know of, but there was the taking of their land allotments. I'm not sure. I haven't been able to piece together how we got our family land back. To this day, we still have some of our land allotments still in our family. But the idea of taking land for headright reasons or just to have the land itself from the land allotments that were granted to the Native Americans, typically around 160 acres each, that is nothing new. It was happening all the time to our Native American ancestors. And yet, really, it was Killers of the Flower Moon that brought this to light. And so I'm incredibly proud of my friend Mike Mushalatubby Simpson, whose talents have graced the screens of numerous films and shows, including the likes of Killers of the Flower Moon, 1883, Yellowstone, Reservation Dogs, Lawman Bass Reeves, and Echo. And the excitement doesn't end there. Mark your calendars for June 2024, as Mike will also make an appearance in the eagerly anticipated new show, Indian Territory. I'm so excited. A performance I am eagerly awaiting, so I will also be watching with y'all. In this clip from Season 1, Episode 2, Mike shares some memories from his time on the set of Killers of the Flower Moon, offering us a glimpse into the magic that unfolds behind the scenes.
I had already seen Leonardo DiCaprio from a distance.
Okay.
We had holding stations, and so a lot of times you'd be able to look out and see who was coming and who was going. And so Leonardo had already come and gone several different times like that. We had a scene in the book that is about the Osage having a delegation and going to Washington, D.C. This is kind of typical of that era that a lot of tribes, would, you know, dress up, get their representatives, and they would go to Washington if they had something they want to try to get over across to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a scene like that. Leonardo had come out there, and we were having this scene, as I said, and I was in that particular group, and there were probably about 50 of us, and we were all kind of dressed a little bit differently. There were some that were dressed in black hats and black coats, and they were the delegates, and you'll see it in the movie.
Yeah.
And then as this shot's going on, there's a person up there in the front that's taking pictures in one of those old box cameras, and we've gone through that a couple of times, you know. And Leonardo walks up, and he's probably, about 10 feet away from me, and he looks at all of the natives right there, and he just pauses a second as he looks, he scans across, and he kind of in a whisper says, "Amazing." And I thought it was amazing, you know, because It hit me, because here we were, all of us together.
Robert De Niro, you know, he played William Hale. Interesting fact, he had an injury on the set. So do you know anything about that?
Yeah, he had a kind of an accident, kind of just took a bad step. Sometimes you do that. I wasn't there when it happened, but apparently he was stepping over something and tore his quad. So he was already planned to leave to go back to New York City and have a point right there to do something. So it worked out pretty well for him, I think.
You know, you've had a few actors from different movies on this show so far. Little parts, big parts. But the story of the Osage is really impressive. Mm-hmm. And I really like the next clip that you have from Jim Gray,
mm-hmm.
who was so close to the actual history. And of course, his history is pretty cool too.
Yeah,
What he's done. And once again, here's another chief that you got to talk to.
Yeah.
Because Jim was the chief of the Osage for a while, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah, so now we're into clips from season two. And during his tenure as chief, Jim Gray left an indelible mark on the Osage Nation as the youngest chief, spearheading significant constitutional reforms for the tribe's advancement. Beyond his administrative prowess, Jim carries a deeply personal connection to the tragic events of the Reign of Terror, being a descendant of Henry Roan, one of its victims, as depicted in the gripping nonfiction narrative and subsequent film that we mentioned, Killers of the Flower Moon. In this compelling excerpt from Season 2, Episode 7, we delve into the remarkable influence Jim and the Osage community wielded on director Martin Scorsese, catalyzing pivotal changes in the cinematic portrayal of their harrowing history.
So a group of Osages got together, and they asked an attorney to write a letter that they could approve and send it to Scorsese and his people, asking for a meeting.
Yeah.
Based on this, you know. We don't want to go out there. We want to invite you here in our community.
Awesome.
You know. And to his credit, he got on a plane from New York and flew to Tulsa. And him and his entourage showed up in Pawhuska. And he didn't want any press.
Yeah.
You know. He just wanted to sit down and listen. We fed him a traditional Osage meal.
Love it.
And there was about 200 Osages that were descendants of those people.
Wow.
That were in the movie, in the book. And we were able to get his attention for about an hour and a half. And each one of us got up and we took the mic and we told him what we felt like he needed to know. Another person got up. It was me.
It was this amazing guy.
It sounds like I'm, you know, it just...
No, come on. We want to hear this. We talked
about this before, you know.
It's hard to talk about yourself. I know. Yeah.
But I just pointed out to him, you know, and I'm no film student. I'm no expert in this industry, but
But you're Osage.
But I'm Osage and I go to movies, you know.
Right.
And I just said, there's one thing I've noticed about, you know, as a journalist at the time, I used to write reviews of movies and things like that. And I just said, the biggest... the most popular three budgeted movies that were blockbusters by Hollywood standards that had an Indian content in it. It was Little Big Man, Dances with Wolves, and Last of the Mohicans.
I was going to say.
What do these three movies have in common? They have a white savior narrative. The difference between the story that you're taking on here and those other three, those were works of fiction. This is nonfiction because the descendants of those people that are in this book and in the movie are in this room.
I mean, how often would any director get that chance?
And
right?
I looked at him and I said, you have an opportunity, sir, to make a movie about indigenous people that Hollywood has never made before. And we want to help you if you let us.
Wow.
And... be the director to make that movie so your entire industry will point to it from now on and say, that's the one we got right. And the whole room just went, you know, and it was just, and he was just like.
What was his reaction?
His eyes got real big because I was about from here to the end of this table from him.
Wow.
And, you know, it's hard not to notice that Martin Scorsese's listening to you.
Thank you, Jim, for sharing his story and his family story, too. What I really love about, you know, that kind of history and learning about the Osage, and really for that book, Killers of the Flower Moon, is it brought to light something that I don't think anybody knew about. You know, I know you say, you know, your podcast is for natives and everyone basically, but maybe in the native community, that story is really well known, but I'd never even heard of it. It was not even on the radar of what was going on with that. And now with the movie being out there, there's so much more light being shined on it. People are starting to understand exactly what was going on. The entire country, federally, were coming after these natives in Oklahoma to say they couldn't manage their own land, their right, their own money, any of those things. So, and with that, I need to feed this monster.
So listeners, we'll continue on with more clips, but I'll let Nick and Taloa go on to dinner time. But before you go, Nick, are there any words of wisdom you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, when it really comes down to it, what you're doing is, I'm really proud of what you're doing. I think you're doing a lot to try to help people get their stories heard. You're giving some history to everybody who's out there. I've heard from a number of folks that you've kept it to the stories. You've kept it to the idea that these stories need to be shared and that you're not sharing your opinion upon it. You're letting people tell their stories. And I think that's kind of the key factor in a world where everybody wants to share their opinions or they want to share their political beliefs.
Right.
Sometimes you just got to shut up and listen. I think that's what we're really trying to do, is just listen to these stories and kind of absorb the history that's missing, just like that Osage stories.
Thank you for that. I love that.
And now I got to go feed this dog. she's starving.
I mean, she only weighs 100 pounds, but she's starving. I was gonna ask her if she has any words of wisdom, but I think she would just say always eat food, y'all. So very wise words from my husband and Taloa. Thanks to you both for joining me today. Chihololi.
Thanks for listening to Native Chalk Talk. Be sure to join our community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check us out at nativechalktalk.com. Stay tuned for the next episode. You're going to love it. Yakoki. Thank you, my friends.